The one that matters today on the world. I'm Marco Werman. President Trump embarks on a 12-day trip to Asia. Before leaving, he told Fox News not to worry about the fact that there's currently no U.S. ambassador to Korea or a special envoy to North Korea.
Let me tell you, the one that matters is me.
What you see is such a revealing comment from Donald Trump. No one matters except for the president himself. That's a much more common sentiment from authoritarian leaders than it is from a president.
We'll have a preview of Trump's trip, plus writer Wajahat Ali wants to reclaim the phrase Allahu Akbar from terrorists.
I said Allahu Akbar while watching, literally last night, the Golden State Warriors come back and beat the Spurs. I'm like, Allahu Akbar. Thank you, Steph Curry.
That's all coming up today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're here with The World. 12 days, 5 countries, 2 international summits. President Trump has set off on the longest foreign trip so far of his presidency. And I didn't even mention an opportunity to cross paths with Russian President Vladimir Putin. What could possibly go wrong?
It's almost a case where we're unilaterally disarming on the diplomacy front.
That's Susan Glasser. In a moment, she'll explain why empty offices at the State Department could make Trump's trip to Asia an especially challenging one for American diplomacy. But let's also ask what could possibly go right. To find out, we called up Isaac Stonefish. He's a senior fellow at the Asia Society in New York. He says at many stops, the preparations for Trump's arrival are lavish.
In Japan and especially in China, Trump will likely have red carpet reception like he couldn't even believe. And it'll be very good for his ego and not necessarily so good for American interests.
We've heard Prime Minister Abe making sure that Tokyo's department stores are stocked with merchandise from Trump's Virginia winery for this visit. I mean, this is for a U.S. president who just a few months ago had called Japanese free riders taking advantage of America's military might. Are Japanese onlookers comfortable with all of this?
I do think it's a very smart move for Abe to give Trump so much face by doing this. And I think when Trump won, Abe was petrified. And even when Trump tries to say nice things about Japan, it can often backfire. Like last night in a Fox interview, Trump called Japan a warrior nation and, you know, and said North Korea should be aware. And those are really unhelpful comments for Japan's relations with its neighbors, who remember Japan being a warrior nation and committing atrocities during World War II.
So in South Korea, Trump's relationship with President Moon Jae-in isn't quite so chummy. Trump has threatened to tear up the 5-year-old U.S.-Korea free trade agreement. But with the North Korea nuclear problem very alive right now, does the South Korean leader seem maybe more inclined to cozy up to Trump?
I think so. And I think a lot's going to depend both on whether or not North Korea decides to test another missile or test another nuclear weapon during this trip. But I think also a lot depends on Trump's energy levels and his mood during this trip.
Trump's stop in China should be pretty interesting. Beijing is expected to pull out all the stops. In fact, China's ambassador to Washington is calling this stop a state visit plus. What's that all about? Why the pomp?
The Chinese correctly understand how important that is for Trump and how useful it is for their interests to really make him feel like he is the center of the world. So I would expect that publicly that the trip perhaps will, quote unquote, go off without a hitch. But I think the real worry is what Trump concedes in private meetings. And these are things we might not know about for years or even decades. But I just don't have much faith, and I think a lot of the people following this don't have much faith in Trump's ability to hold his own on one-on-one meetings or small meetings with Xi.
So, Isaac, 12 days away from Washington, a lot can happen. We know Trump is on the record as finding raw fish disgusting, but aside from stepping in it socially and culturally, what do you think the dangers are for President Trump in this sort of extended trip?
I think one of the most worrying things he could do is, in a secret meeting with, say, Chinese Communist Party Secretary Xi, bargain away U.S. support for Taiwan, which has been a really important part of our Asia strategy for decades, in exchange for Chinese support for North Korea when there's so many better ways to resolve that issue.
Yeah, I mean, what about his lack of experience on a 12-day trip? How do you think that's going to play into how he presents himself?
There's a lot of subtleties with diplomacy in the region that Trump will either inadvertently or purposefully overlook. The two issues here are his lack of experience, but also his lack of self-control and his desire to be at the center of these meetings, these things. There's that famous video where he pushed aside the prime minister of what, Montenegro, to get closer to a photo op. And it just, speaking very frankly, it just makes America look bad. And it makes China look better by comparison that their leader acts publicly with poise and with respect.
Isaac Stonefish is a senior fellow at the Asia Society in New York. As President Trump embarks on this trip, many key jobs in his State Department are still unfilled. The president was asked about that during an interview with Fox News yesterday.
Let me tell you, the one that matters is me. I'm the only one that matters because when it comes to it, that's what the policy is going to be. You've seen that. You've seen it strongly.
We often turn to Susan Glasser for insight into American diplomacy. She is Politico's chief international affairs columnist. So, Susan, North Korea is going to be one of the top issues during this trip. North Korea is, of course, an ongoing issue, but the U.S. still doesn't have an ambassador in neighboring South Korea. That would seem to be key to this whole process. Has this vacancy already affected talks on the nuclear crisis?
Well, I think there's no doubt that it has. Not only has Trump been skeptical publicly of diplomacy in the crisis, but there's no assistant secretary who's in charge of it. Normally in the past, that person has been one of the most senior U.S. diplomats and has played a role even more like an envoy in the Pacific region. And now we haven't had anyone like that in the midst of this crisis. And in general, I think what you see is such a revealing comment from Donald Trump, right? He is basically expressing almost a sort of l'état c'est moi philosophy of government in which no one matters except for the president himself. That's a much more common sentiment from authoritarian leaders than it is from a democratic president.
The comment is really stunning. I mean, Trump does have a top diplomat, Rex Tillerson. How much pushback from him is he getting?
Well, look, obviously, that's been one of the big spectacles here in Washington unfolding over the last several months, is that the very clear, repeated public dissing by the president of his own top diplomat. And I think that in the medium term to long term, it makes it basically impossible for Rex Tillerson to do his job.
So what are some of the other vacancies in the State Department and beyond that you think will have an impact on diplomatic talks this week?
Well, look, I mean, as I mentioned, the assistant secretary for Asia has long been one of the premier posts in United States Foreign Service. There are also empty ambassadorships in many of the key countries in the region. Basically, we're just not showing up at certain tables where we've been at the past. And I think, of course, it's going to have a direct impact on our diplomacy. There's just no question about it.
So those offices at the State Department getting more empty, I just want to clarify this. Are there nominees that are just not getting confirmed, or is the whole thing just getting more and more empty?
Well, I think it's actually the whole thing getting more and more empty, and that's very striking. Up until recently, certainly, it wasn't that Congress was behind as a percentage-wise of confirming nominees. It was that there was a much lower number, significantly lower number of overall nominees at this point compared with previous administrations. And then also the disruption of the U.S. Foreign Service, the professional diplomats who advise and are experts on these issues, is another kind of hidden story, I think, about the Trump administration. You have had really the most senior professional diplomats, many of them have been basically told to leave their jobs by Trump or marginalized and taken out of position. So it's almost a case where we're unilaterally disarming on the diplomacy front.
Yeah, what are you hearing from career foreign service people overseas right now?
I mean, this is an epic level of demoralization. I don't think anybody can remember this level of discord and dismay inside the U.S. Foreign Service. And there's a fear that we'll be losing, in effect, a whole generation of diplomats, either people who just will not go into the Foreign Service, combined with rising mid-career professionals who are choosing to leave now in significant numbers rather than stick it out.
Susan Glasser, Politico's chief international affairs columnist, thanks very much.
Thank you so much for having me.
One country President Trump will not be visiting on his Asia tour is Mongolia. No big surprise, Mongolia has a small population, and it's often overshadowed anyway by its powerful neighbors, Russia to the north, China to the south. Still, look out for Mongolia because it's starting to flex its economic muscle, especially when it comes to mining. Lots of mineral resources in Mongolia, including a lot of gold. Problem is, getting that gold out of the ground can be a very dirty business, especially for small-scale miners. But reporter Ann Bailey says that's starting to change.
A hand-cranked cable lowers me down a 70-foot dirt shaft into a narrow black tunnel. The space is so small that you can't stand up. But there are three men down here, and they use their headlamps to show me the section of rock where they've been digging. We're in a small gold mine about 2 hours north of Mongolia's capital, Ulaanbaatar. Mongolia is home to lots of small gold mines like this one, and plenty of big ones, too. Until about a decade ago, many of them used mercury to extract the gold from the ore. And that was a big problem.
Mercury can accumulate in the food chain and convert to methyl mercury, which is toxic to humans.
That's Salim Ali, a professor of energy and environmental policy at the University of Queensland, who studied mining in Mongolia. The country recognized these health and environmental concerns a decade ago and shut down all centralized gold processing plants that used mercury. It was a change that the big companies could take in stride. But the little guys, like the ones I met, were left on their own. That's when Narensok Belku stepped up. We didn't really know what we were going to do at first, Belku says. But we were able to connect with some specialists in Switzerland who taught us about non-mercury technology. Belku was one of 32 independent gold miners who formed a local cooperative after Mongolia's ban on mercury. A couple years later, with the help of a Swiss government agency, he opened the first non-mercury facility in the country for small miners around the town of Bornor. The ore passes through a crusher and roller mill until it's pulverized into dirt. But then the dirt heads to what's called a shaking table, which uses water and gravity instead of water and mercury to separate out the gold.
You see that speckles? Just small, tiny bit? That's the gold.
That's my translator, Baska.
So they will actually collect all the gold into these three metal boxes. It's a long process.
Long and not terribly efficient, says Dr. Salim Ali.
Using just water, you are not likely to be successful once you start to get to low-grade deposits.
Ali says most big gold mines in Mongolia now use cyanide to extract gold because it works better with those lower-grade deposits, and it's less toxic than mercury. Some artisanal miners have turned to cyanide too, but it can still be harmful. Miner Narensok Belku says gravitational water processing can protect the environment better and still recover more than 80% of the gold from the ore. At the small mine near the Bornor plant, Belku's colleague Dambi Surunjav Tovchinumjargal says he's glad to be part of a water processing cooperative. Sometimes we don't get anything from here, Tovchinumjargal says. But whenever we do get gold, we actually make decent money. And Salim Ali says it's vital income in a country without a lot of ways to make a living.
You know, this country has enormous mineral reserves and they don't have much else.
And yet, advocates for independent miners say the government has been slow to help them out by investing in more water processing plants like this one. To date, only three have been built. They still don't understand what we are trying to do, Belku says. Salim Ali says the government is reluctant to encourage what it sees as a largely unregulated industry. But Belku says people will keep digging up gold here with or without government help and processing it with or without mercury. So the government should invest in plants that help these small-scale miners do it without poisoning themselves and the environment. And he wants this plant to be an example. My hope is to help the small miners operate well so that the government will support us, Belku says. That's my hope. For the world, Ann Bailey, Bornor, Mongolia.
You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. The hashtag MeToo has been prominent on social media lately as more and more women and some men have spoken out about their experiences with sexual harassment. Here's another hashtag we've been following, Ni Una Menos, Spanish for Not One Woman Less. The hashtag is part of a campaign that started 2 years ago in Argentina against femicide, the targeted murder of women, and other forms of gender-based violence. Carla Zabludovsky has been reporting on the movement for BuzzFeed News. A quick answer to get us started, Carla. Have women's rights improved in Argentina?
On paper, they have. In real life, women are getting killed in higher rates than they have been in recent years. Women feel less safe, and the kinds of violence that they're being subjected to have become, you know, even more brutal.
So let's just focus on the Ni Una Menos movement, which you've been following. How effective has this one group been? Like, what's been their biggest achievement?
Well, they put the conversation on the table. They emerged in 2015 after a brutal femicide, and there was a massive march. They put certain words, like, in the mainstream that were necessary to start having a productive conversation, like patriarchy and what this means for where women stand in society. And it's allowing women to have a conversation about what they want to change about it. You know, it also made women realize that they don't have to tolerate being catcalled on the street or abused by their partners. And it went international. You know, it started in Argentina, and now there have been marches all over Latin America, which is a region where femicides are very concerning and are rapidly increasing in many places. So I think its biggest achievement so far is the awareness that it raised.
But as you say, if the reality on the ground is still a violent reality for women, where has the group been unable to get traction?
Well, they did force the government to pass a law to protect women more seriously, but implementation has been very, very slow. The government does not seem to be making this issue a priority. Earlier this year, as per one of the promises that the government made, they announced that they would be opening 3 new safe houses for women. But then the government sent a press release disclosing the locations of these safe houses, which is incredibly concerning. You know, these are places where women have to be out of reach of their aggressors.
I'd like it if you told us about one case. You recently wrote about the murder of Michaela Garcia. You described her as devoting her life to keeping women safe, but then was killed by a man. Was this a high-profile case? How did you find out about her?
Yes, it's a very high-profile case. Michaela Garcia was a 21-year-old student. She was part of Ni Una Menos. She marched in Ni Una Menos demonstrations. She came from a middle-class background, from a very caring, tight-knit family. She was a good girl.
And when was she murdered, and who killed her?
She was murdered 6 months ago. She was out at a club with her girlfriends, and she left at 5 a.m. And it's a very safe place. People walk outside on the street at all times of the day and night, and nothing happens. And along the way, a man stopped a car near her, and another man in the car got out, forced her into the car. The two took turns raping her, and they strangled her, and then they discarded her naked body on the side of a road.
Has there been any prosecution?
Yes. Sebastian Wagner is the main suspect, and he was sentenced to life in prison. And the other man in the car, who was his boss at a car wash, his defense was able to get a 5-year conviction for covering up Sebastian Wagner's crimes, not for actually being in the car or hurting Michaela.
Can you help us understand what the atmosphere is in Argentina that allows these crimes against women to persist? Is it an increase in violence? Is it just getting reported more? Has Ni Una Menos lost steam?
It's just an incredibly machista country where street harassment is so common and very violent. And activists told me that one of their theories is because movements like Ni Una Menos have empowered women, have made them aware that they don't have to tolerate what they've been subjected to, that the kinds of abuse and violence they've been subjected to their whole lives, and that men don't want to let go of the power that they've held over women. And I was actually the victim of street harassment myself. I was walking in a kind of a very upscale shopping neighborhood, just window shopping, and a man started following me, and he kept getting closer, and he had a very angry expression, and he seemed like he wanted to hit me. It's like an even greater sense of propriety.
Carla Zabludowsky, a reporter with BuzzFeed News. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Marco.
Let's switch gears now and talk about Liberia. The West African nation is in the process of electing a new president. The two remaining candidates are both men. The incumbent is Ellen Johnson Sirleaf, who became Africa's first elected female head of state 12 years ago. Under her leadership, Liberia has been continuing its recovery from a devastating civil war in the 1990s and also from the effects of the Ebola outbreak in 2014. And one strategy the Liberian government has been pursuing is to support young entrepreneurs, like the businesswoman we're about to hear from, courtesy of our friends at the BBC.
I'm Patrice Jua from Liberia, and I'm a writer, poet, entrepreneur, girls' education advocate, and former Miss Liberia World. Being an African girl is really tough. You have to take care of your family, you have household chores to take care of, and sometimes you even have to drop out of school. But those things didn't happen to me because my mom was a teacher and a disciplinarian who instilled in me a value and appreciation for education at a young age. I grew up in an entrepreneurial setting where I saw my mom do different things. I saw her sew, I saw her design, I saw her bake during the war to help us aside from teaching. So when I won the Miss Liberia pageant, I've always had a desire to promote Liberian art. So I started a business in 2008, and it was a small fashion, textile, and creative business. And the goal was to represent and brand the Liberian creative and textile industries with the use of our traditional woven fabric, the country cloth. The country cloth is a beautiful woven fabric that has been around in our culture for many years. But with people who used to do it back in the day getting older, the tradition is quickly becoming extinct. So we decided to promote it and use it predominantly in most of our designs to have it compete with other fabrics like the kente of Ghana and other traditional fabrics in other African countries. So we are on Camp Johnson Road. This is where I first ran my business. And during the Ebola outbreak, I had to shut it down because people weren't really buying from us because fashion wasn't what was needed at the time. So we had to shut the business down. And it's a bit emotional for me standing here today, remembering, you know, all of the things that we did here. Three tips I would give to young women who want to be successful is to be yourself and no other person but yourself. Seek mentors because you cannot do it alone. If you push enough, you can find yourself a good mentor who will help guide you along your journey. And always be able to think beyond your circumstances and the limitations that are around you. So be authentic, look for mentors, and think beyond your limitations and circumstances.
Great advice there from Liberian writer, businesswoman, and advocate for girls' education, Patrice Jua, speaking there with our colleagues at the BBC. News headlines are up next, right here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. Zaire, 1974, Foreman versus Ali in the ring, and on stage, B.B. King versus Franco and the Teapot Jazz.
Franco went on and he tore it up, and afterward, B.B. King said to me, I ain't following that, man. Really, I ain't going up there, you know.
The musical Rumble in the Jungle, that's ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. We've been talking a lot this week about the Diversity Visa Lottery, also known as the Green Card Lottery. That's because a suspect in Tuesday's vehicle attack in New York reportedly came into the country through that program. So do 50,000 other people each year. They're selected at random, but they're also vetted for criminal records. On Wednesday, White House spokesperson Sarah Huckabee Sanders said the program should be abolished.
All I know is that you can't randomly select people and not have them thoroughly vetted and not have the ability to know whether or not these people want to do good things or bad things when they get here. I don't think it's unreasonable to ask that people that want to come to this country go through a vetting process to make sure that when they get here, they want to contribute to society and not harm the people of this country.
Abdi Nor Iftin is one of the hundreds of thousands of people who have benefited from the lottery over the years. He was living as a Somali refugee in Kenya when he won a ticket on the lottery, and he now lives in Maine. His story is one that we've been following on The World. He was also featured on This American Life. But since the Green Card Lottery is back in the news, I want to ask Abdi, why is it so important to so many people? Abdi, welcome. Can you answer that question?
Yes, indeed. The diversity visa program is very important for those of us who otherwise might not be able to come to the United States through student visa or sponsorship or refugee. You know, that involves a lot of tough things, like you have to have money or you have to have education and stuff like that. So the whole point here is we just want to make life. We just want to be like everybody else, go to school, find jobs, become taxpayers, and most importantly, become American citizens. So I applied so that I could come to the U.S. and live the American dream.
When you heard that clip of Sarah Huckabee Sanders earlier implying that people like you don't have the skills to make the U.S. better, how does that make you feel?
That makes me feel like they think every diversity lottery winner is just like the same guy in New York who run over people. You know, so many of us are going to schools. We're going to schools, we're graduating, we're helping the community. We're bilinguals. We're, you know, part of the community. We're just super excited for who we are, where we are, and we're proud of it. That one individual does not stand for me. He does not represent me. The White House spokesperson or whoever she was and the president of the United States are not paying attention to the good people that came to this country with the diversity visa lottery.
Isn't there some logic, though, in making all of those 50,000 annual visas in the lottery eligible to people according to their specific skills and talents? Would that not be fair?
So one thing that makes America great is the diversity, is the different people that come to this country. So in this case, yes, there is already a program for people with the skills to come to this country. There's so many different visas, but the diversity visa lottery is the one easiest way that you could not be discriminated. It's just one of the amazing things that America does. Mm. And I know that so many Americans don't pay attention to this, but yes, so many people pay attention to this.
Finally, Abdi, your story as a lottery winner has become quite well known through This American Life. Have other lottery applicants been contacting you since Trump's announcement that he wants to get rid of the diversity visa program?
A lot. You can't imagine how many calls and text messages and friend requests on Facebook that I received from people who are so freaked out and they want me to explain what's going on. I mean, is Trump canceling this and what's going to happen? And some of the people who reached out to me are the winners of 2016. That means they should be arriving sometime in the next month or so. They have to go to their interview. What's going to happen to them? Sometimes I look at myself and I say, oh gosh, I'm the luckiest man on earth because I've been here before Trump was elected.
Abdi, you waited for months. You prayed. Describe the moment you realized you had been selected at random as a winner in this visa lottery.
It was just, you know, what should I say? I mean, it's just like you going to Mars or something, you know, that kind of feeling. Like, yeah, that kind of feeling like you leave, you know, you're going to somewhere that you thought was not possible, but then now you realize that it's possible. That was the feeling that was going through my, you know, my mind all that time. To me, like, it was just my prayers have been answered.
Abdi Noor Iftin won a green card through the U.S. Diversity Visa Lottery Program. His book, Call Me American, about the lottery process, comes out next year. Abdi, thanks so much.
Thank you, Marco.
Something else that made it back into the news this week because of that attack in New York on Tuesday when that man drove a truck down a bike path killing 8 people. The Arabic phrase Allahu Akbar, or God is greatest. The phrase was quickly cited as evidence of the attacker's motivations before investigators could confirm anything. But Allahu Akbar is a pretty innocuous and common expression among Muslims. In the New York Times, writer Wajahat Ali recently wrote about reclaiming the phrase.
I say it like 100 times a day, not to freak out your listeners, because it's said in prayer. So when Muslims who are supposed to pray 5 times a day, most of us don't, the first thing they do in prayer is say Allahu Akbar. And within each cycle of prayer, you say it like 5 or 6 times. So if you add it up and you're praying 5 times a day, and also you're using it as a lexical Swiss army knife, which most of us do, as an expression of gratitude. You know, I said Allahu Akbar while watching literally last night the Golden State Warriors come back and beat the Spurs. I'm like, Allahu Akbar. Thank you, Steph Curry. And 2 nights ago on my birthday, I said Allahu Akbar right when I bit into a succulent, tasty halal chicken kebab. Unfortunately, language oftentimes is hijacked by violent extremists. I have lived 37 years. I and the overwhelming majority of Muslims have never used it before or after a violent act. It's said during prayer and after something as innocuous. And I said this in the piece, I have no problem saying it on air. A couple of days ago, I had a stomach virus. Sometimes you lose the battle, but you win the war against the stomach virus. And when you do, you say, Allahu Akbar.
So when you heard reports that the attacker in New York on Tuesday had said, Allahu Akbar, what was your reaction?
I mean, I was watching the rolling coverage, right? And they said, oh, incident happened. And then they said, suspect said Allahu Akbar, now FBI is investigating as an incident of terrorism. I'm like, really? That's the marker of terrorism? And what we've seen since 9/11 is the label of terrorism is not applied based on the act and the intent. It's oftentimes applied only based on ethnicity and religion. And so I sat there and said, Groundhog Day all over again. I know exactly what's going to happen. Allahu Akbar is going to trend. Extremists on both sides are going to use it for their ideological agenda. And maybe it's time for me to be a Muslim Wikipedia entry and inform people what Allahu Akbar really means. And I said, wait for it. Donald Trump, who was unable to properly criticize white supremacists who use the same exact method of terror in Charlottesville. Both sides are to blame. There's some very fine people. And I think it's been 2 months, Marco, and he did not call it yet an act of domestic terrorism. I said, wait for it. He's going to exploit it. And lo and behold, within a day, he did.
There's also with these attacks now this moment between kind of lightning and thunder when the attack happens and then we all wait to see the kind of person who did it. And now it feels like we're also asking, did they say Allahu Akbar or not? It's become like this tainted shorthand. What does that moment of waiting become for you? What goes through your mind?
It's called the Muslim drill, and I've talked about it before. And it's not just Muslims, but most people of color in this country pray to God that it's just like an average white dude who did it. Not because we have anything against white dudes, but if it's a white dude, we know that all of our white brethren will not be indicted, convicted, or sentenced based on the criminal actions of one person. When it's a Muslim, your entire species is on trial. 1.7 billion people in 1,400 years of Islamic civilization. And then you have to engage in the endless condemnathons and condemn violent acts done by people you've never met. It's like Die Hard 2, condemn 2, condemn harder. If you don't condemn enough, people always, you know, they always use it to question your loyalty and patriotism. But this time, it was a bit different, Marco, because overwhelmingly, the people who responded to me, fellow Americans, non-Muslims, were appreciative. They said, listen, man, when I heard Allahu Akbar all these years, literally, I don't want to be like a jerk, but I was scared because all I saw in the news was terrorism. But what you said makes a lot of sense. Thanks for informing me.
Yeah, so that indicates a little progress. But still, do you ever find yourself policing what you say? Because you know the story last year, an Iraqi refugee, a student at Berkeley, was kicked off a plane after ending a cell phone call with the phrase, inshallah, or God willing.
Unconsciously, yes, it has changed somehow the way we behave because you realize that your multisyllable name, your religious identity, and even saying something as innocuous as Allahu Akbar in an age of ignorance and fear can be used against you. At the end of the day, you're like, do I really want to go through this crap of like getting kicked off a plane or getting TSA bothering me just because, you know, I said Allahu Akbar? And most people say no. But at the same time, you know, life is short, man, and I'm not doing anything wrong. And I refuse to let haters and extremists hijack the normalcy of our daily lives. And so if that means I have to work a little bit harder just to explain it to people, so be it.
It's not a funny topic, but at least you bring some humor to the table. And I had to laugh again yesterday when the internet spotted several TV newscasters reporting on the New York attack, mispronouncing Allahu Akbar as Alu Akbar, which translates to what?
Potatoes are great.
Yeah.
I love potatoes. Some of my best meals have potatoes in them. who doesn't like potatoes? If you don't like potatoes, something is wrong with you. So if we can't agree on Allahu Akbar, I think most Americans can agree Alu Akbar. Yeah. Potatoes are great.
Writer Wajahat Ali, his essay in the New York Times is titled, I Want Allahu Akbar Back. Okay, so we're reaching that time of the year when we're going to start hearing about candidates for Word of the Year, you know, some word or phrase that got used a lot in the past year, and maybe encapsulates something telling about the times we live in. One strong contender?
They show up in the helmets and the black masks, and they've got clubs and they've got everything. Antifa!
Antifa, or is it Antifa? The world's Lydia Jean Cott has been looking into the history of this word for our World in Words podcast, and she joins me now in the studio. What is the right way to pronounce that word?
There's lots of ways, Marco.
Antifa.
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 Antifa isn't actually in the dictionary right now. It's a word that Merriam-Webster is tracking to see if it gets used enough to eventually get added. So lots of different people say it in lots of different ways.
All right. So we heard the president earlier describe the group, but what does Antifa actually mean? Like the word itself, where does it come from?
So the word is short for anti-fascist, and it's the name of a movement, a political movement. And the followers of this movement, they believe in doing everything they possibly can to stop racists and fascists from coming to power. And its history, it actually goes all the way back to before World War II in Italy. When Mussolini was first coming to power, he had this group called the Black Shirts. And they basically went after anyone that didn't agree with him, and they beat him up. Particularly, they went after leftists. So these leftist groups, they formed militias, kind of like, you know, their own ragtag militias to fight back. And since Mussolini's party was called the National Fascist Party, when the English-speaking press was reporting about what was going on in Italy at the time, they called these people, his opponents, anti-fascists.
And what about the abbreviation for that, Antifa? When did people start using that?
That started in Germany. When Hitler was coming to power, he copied Mussolini, and he had a group called the Brown Shirts, and they went after anyone that didn't agree with him. And again, it was a lot of leftist groups. So once again, these leftists kind of came together and formed their own militias to fight back. And one of these groups, it was actually called Antifascistische Aktion, which for short became known as Antifa.
Die Kommunistische Partei Deutschlands ruft euch zur antifaschistischen Aktion auf.
Antifascistische Aktion. How did Antifa go from being the nickname for this group that fought Nazis in the 1930s in Germany to the name of a movement now here in the U.S.?
So there's a long and complicated history behind that, which we get into the podcast. But the short of it is Antifa came to the U.S. this way. During the 80s and the 90s in the U.K., there is a lot of confrontations happening at punk concerts between skinheads and anti-racist skinheads. And a lot of those anti-racist skinheads, they hearkened back to Antifa as a way to gain legitimacy. A lot of them were even part of this network called Anti-Fascist Action, which is a direct translation of Antifascistische Aktion.
Wow, it's all connected, isn't it?
Yeah. This is an early 90s song by the Scottish band Oi Polloi. And it kind of became an anti-fascist anthem. I don't know if you can quite make it out, but
I'm not hearing a lot, except a lot of heavy chords. But
what they're saying is bash the fash. And it's through punk that the movement made the leap across the pond to the U.S., although it went by a different name here.
What was it called?
Anti-racist action.
Huh.
So what happened was, in Minneapolis in 1987, there was a group of punks. They went by the name the Baldies, and they were basically teenagers. And they were worried about this new neo-Nazi group in their town. And one of them had read in an anarchist magazine about anti-fascist action in the UK. And she was inspired by this idea of confronting racists and fascists, like, directly out on the streets. And the Baldies, they decided to start something similar here in the United States, but they decided to call it anti-racist action because they thought that the word racist, it carried more weight and had more of a resonance than the word fascist, at least at that particular time.
And the shortened form of the word Antifa, I feel like it was this year that I heard it for the first time. When did people start using it in the U.S.?
So there were a few groups here and there in the early 2000s that called themselves Antifa because, as through social media, the world became more connected. These different groups all around the world became more connected. But it really became a thing in 2016. The group NYC Antifa says that the number of their followers on Twitter, it quadrupled in just the first 3 weeks of January, right after the presidential inauguration.
That's incredible.
And Antifa has become more and more part of our pop culture and even music. Here's the band Green Day with a modern update on an 80s Antifa song called Born to Die by the band MDC. They're saying, no Trump, no KKK, no fascist USA.
The world's Lydia Giancott. What an etymology there. You can hear her full story about the word Antifa or Antifa on The World in Words. Find it on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. Lydia Jean, thanks so much.
Thank you, Marco.
K Kinshasa, Zaire, now the Democratic Republic of the Congo. It's the fall of 1974.
Muhammad Ali takes on George Foreman in a bid to regain his heavyweight crown in the fight billed as the Rumble in the Jungle.
The fight was certainly treated as epic at the time, but in the years since, it's come to be seen as downright historic. Muhammad Ali's robe is at the Smithsonian in Washington. There have been books and two films, including the 1996 Academy Award-winning documentary, When We Were Kings. Back in 1974, the Rumble in the Jungle was scheduled for a September date, but had to be postponed by a month. A three-day music festival that was supposed to coincide with the fight couldn't be rescheduled, so it went ahead as planned, and that festival has taken on a life of its own, becoming the focus of a great documentary a few years ago called Soul Power.
This man will freeze your knees. If you will, let's all welcome the world's godfather of soul, Soul Brother Number One, James Brown!
Soul Power focused on the American soul and Latin artists who played the gig in Kinshasa.
We had this incredible array of who's who in Black American music at the time.
That's American music producer Stuart Levine. He organized the American acts for the music festival. Along with James Brown, there was also B.B. King, The Spinners, Bill Withers, The Fania All-Stars. Soul Power is a wonderful trip back in musical time, but noticeably absent from the doc, the African artists, Taboulay Rochereau, Franco and the Teapot Jazz Ensemble, Miriam Makeba, musicians super well known on the continent, less so here, until this year. A few months ago, a double CD came out that highlights these artists. It's called Zaire 74. Kinshasa oyo, etona na makambo e. Mobali oyo na tiaki motema poto vanda. Ame misienga, mokumba pe alimwe yeo. Mama, Dalia, namuna kanio. Dalia, namuna kanio. So, Stuart, how much of this project, this release of this two CD set, Zaire 74, The African Artist, how much of it is kind of an intentional righting a wrong and reminding people that there were also some great African artists who performed?
Well, you hit it right on the head, Marco. It was us waking up to what we had not really fulfilled, which was to at least have this music heard. And it is very much an example of what was missed during those years. You know, just unawareness by all audiences toward this music. So I think it's well put to say it's the righting of a wrong. It's us righting our wrong, and also the audience being able to hear just how staggeringly great these performers were, particularly on that night.
That's one of Miriam Makeba's performances. Hugh Masekela was Stuart Levine's counterpart in Africa, curating the African acts for the festival. Now keep in mind, these recordings for Zaire 74 were made live, with no chance to have any second takes. Masekela hadn't even heard these tapes since the 70s.
Listening to Zaire 74, we were blown away because we didn't know 40 years later how dynamic the music was and how different it was from the regular music that people expected, especially from Congolese artists, or that they were familiar with, you know, because these people really prepared for the festival and like the excellence of their performances, I think, like, testifies to that.
Who was the African artist that you didn't know that well who really blew you away with their talent at the time?
I had lived in Africa. There was nobody I didn't know, really.
You had already had a couple of hits in 1974 here in the States. Why didn't you play at the concert? You seem like you would have been the perfect kind of artist.
Well, putting together a festival like that was a seven-month job that, like, Stuart Levine and myself and our team had to put together. And, like, to put together a festival that far away from the States was a double job.
So there was When We Were Kings, not to mention Soul Power. A third film focusing on the African musicians could be well received, but will it get made?
I don't think so. Our feeling about this is there have been two films about this subject.
Producer Stuart Levine again.
There isn't enough suitable footage to, or real interest, to be honest with you, to do a third one. The idea is, I don't know, if you close your eyes and listen to this music, I think you end up there, you know. If you close your eyes, you're in Zaire, because the energy, the enthusiasm of the audience and the performers, and more than the audience even, this was the biggest moment in their lives. Here they were in their hometown on a stage in front of 60,000 people, when maybe the largest audience any of them ever played for was 1,000 people. That fabulous sound system, and they were able to tear it up. And they also were, after showing the American artists that they could take care of business, you know. There was a certain kind of competitive spirit, I think, that had something to do with the fight. But also, you know, as quiet as this kept, great musicians love to cut one another, you know. Franco went on and he tore it up, and afterward B.B. King said to me, I ain't following that, man. Really, I ain't going up there, you know. The African audiences, the Congolese audiences, they were, as much as they were dancing to James Brown, they were grooving to Franco and OK Jazz, you know. It was fantastic for them. So they played at the height of their powers.
Franco and T-Pac Jazz live on stage in Kinshasa in 1974. They were, as Levine said, at the height of their powers. So I get what B.B. King was feeling. They were a very tough act to follow. Music from the late Franco Luambo and the T-Pac Jazz, from the new release Zaire 74, The African Artists, the musicians who played the music festival for the big fight between Muhammad Ali and George Foreman. Ali won that rumble in the jungle, by the way, knocking out Foreman in the eighth round. The show's technical knockout is our clock, and our clock says it's time to go. From the Nana Bill Harris Studios at WGBH here in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. Our theme music was composed by Eric Goldberg. You all have yourselves a great weekend.
PRI, Public Radio International.